Philosophers in
Space.
I don't pretend to understand Brannigan's Law. I merely enforce it.
Listen, I'm not the nicest guy in the universe, because I'm the smartest, and being nice is something stupid people do to hedge their bets.
So, do you know what I'm gonna do before I do it?
Yes.
What if I do something different?
Then I don't know that.
Cool.
I wish I read that book by that wheelchair guy.
And welcome to Philosophers in Space. This is episode 45. I'm Thomas Smith. That over there is Aaron. How are you doing, Aaron?
Thomas, darling. Oh my God, it's so good to see you again. I'm doing wonderful. How are you? No?
Can you get your stuff off of my control surface here? I'm trying to record it.
I would like to have some pate now. Spread it.
Now, we're of course going to cover the episode 22, season 4. Of Star Trek, which is called Half a Life and features Oksana Troy. And in the first 15 minutes, you would be forgiven if you thought the ethical question we were going to approach would be, is it ethical to murder Oksana Troy on the bridge? But it eventually turns into quite a good episode.
I hope appreciate my impression.
It was good.
After your John Travolta, which was really earth-shattering, I feel like I have to up my game here. So
yeah, and speaking of, if you're a patron, you're hearing this right on time, hop on to that $10 level and enjoy a juicy, nice, long NASA One Battlefield Earth. You're going to want to catch that. That was fun.
Brains for everybody.
Rat brain, yeah. Listen, rat brain. Go download the episode. But oh, I wanted to make sure to give the context for your excellent impression of Oksana.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Is that her name?
Loaksana Troy, I believe.
Loaksana. Loaksana, yeah.
I can't pronounce any of our listeners' names, but I can get Loaksana down.
He can nail the what's
Shuang
the race again?
Loaksana, no problem.
Yeah, what's the race again?
Betazoids?
White. No. Oh, yeah, Betazoid. No, Betazoid, yeah. yeah, you can nail Betazoid language, but you can't. Yeah. That's the problem. Yeah. Aaron knows every, Star Trek language. He just hasn't mastered English yet for named. You know, and I talk a big talk, but I'm terrible with it, too. So, but it's more fun to make fun of you. So, anyway. This episode was really good, but it was incredibly irritating for the first like 15, 20 minutes. It's like you're on an official, this isn't like a casual cruise ship they're on. Like is there some rule in Starfleet manual that's like if someone's mom comes to the ship, then they can do whatever they want?
I think it's like a post-scarcity world kind of thing. Like everyone's just super chill.
It's incredibly irritating. And I think the most irritating thing about this character that I'm glad that she gets the last half of an episode to be good in. Like, it ends up okay. But, like, the most irritating thing is she's from a race of people that can read minds. Like, she, you know, like her whole species is read minds, feel people. And yet she's constantly the most irritating person ever.
Yeah.
And I don't know why they wrote her that way. You would think. I don't know. Like, I mean, this is not the topic, I guess. But you'd think if you were a mind reading, you know, emotion sensing species that like when every single person on the ship is like, oh, my God, I hate this person. So you'd be like, oh, OK, maybe let me moderate my behavior a little.
She's right? I had the same reaction for the first couple of seasons with this character where I was like, how could you have an empath also be a narcissist? Like, those are diametrically opposed concepts. But the payoff, like, in this episode and a couple other Star Trek episodes with her makes it all worth it. Like, the reason they do it, I think, is because they set her up this way so that when you see the other side of her, it's that much more effective. And like, she's just a larger than life character. I love her as an original style character. Maybe that's just
me. I can't go that far.
I know. But, I know. You know that she's the wife of Gene Roddenberry, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it's not a situation that I, as far as I know, where it's like, from what I gather, she wasn't like a huge pain and everyone hated her on set. She was actually quite lovely. And the character is not just like, you know, not just her John Travolta, is what I'm saying.
Anyway, another important note about this episode, David Ogden Stiers is in it. And I always knew, you know, offhand that like, oh, yeah, I know that name. I kind of recognize him. But looking at that guy's resume, holy moly. Mm-hmm. He died recently, I think.
He died this past year. Yeah.
And wow, what a talented guy that was. Yeah. Man, he was, I mean, somehow, like, watch this episode and then realize this guy played Cogsworth in Beauty and the Beast. Like, I don't even understand.
Mm. Like, yeah, go watch a little bit of MASH, right?
Yeah, that too. But still, like, it's not even the same person.
No, I know.
You know, it's amazing. And then also, he apparently was a conductor and, like, guest conducted like 70 something symphonies all over the world, and he also went to Juilliard. This guy is amazing, and he was really, really good in this episode. I think it's got to be not an easy task to be like, okay, brilliant actor, you're gonna play an alien, and it's like, great. So better work on my rat brain. Rat brain. But I think he did it in a way that made sense, and he kind of, so we can tell you what, we'll use this to hop into our exposition machine here.
You're traveling through another dimension beyond that which is known to podcasters. It is the middle ground between fair use and copyright infringement, between ordinary fanboying and meaningful analysis. It is the exposition zone.
So we meet David Ogden Stiers as a member of a species or race of aliens that is from a planet whose sun is failing.
like you do.
The star is like, it's just not working.
Yeah. This is like 70% of populated planets in the Star Trek universe.
Yeah, I didn't. That's true. Oh, my gosh. And it's so, you know, I won't go on a rant. It's easy for me to rant.
Save it for After Dark.
I like a lot of Star Trek. It's just there's a lot about it that's really funny. But anyway, yeah, the star is just not pulling its weight. It's just kind of, I don't know. So they need to launch some like encouragement missiles into it. They're trying to figure out how to revitalize the star to have enough energy, I guess, to be able to support the planet. And this species of alien, as is often the case in Star Trek, can be summarized as a whole by a couple characteristics.
Yeah.
It's what they do in the show. The entire species of alien, they all have these like couple things, you know, like, oh, this is the planet where everybody, you know, like how insane that would be to say that about Earth. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Earth is the planet where every single human does X. It's like, well, okay, we don't all have the same person. Like, there's differences. But anyway, forget all that. This is a very xenophobic planet, which, all right, I could buy that they would all be a certain level of xenophobic. But they're also very, you know, closely guarded. They haven't had a lot of contact. Nobody knows much about them. And you come to find out, da-da-dum, that they have a custom in their society where when you reach the age of 60, you kill yourself. And it's the conflict arises, A, because of, I mean, just on its face, that's a difficult thing. But also, David Ogden Stiers is on the verge of figuring out the science of how to fix this star, to pop the hood and get the star working again. And he's just, they think they have it, but then the test goes wrong and the conflict arises because he's so close, but they are pretty rigid in their kill yourself at 60 rule on this planet. And Loaxana Troi, the most annoying character in the Star Trek universe, again, it's redeemed a little in this episode, but still it's tough watching for 15 or 20 minutes. As she does oftentimes, you know what I love about another thing about the Star Trek universe? So many times people are, now I don't know if this will be the future, but people are just DTF any species, you know, mm-hmm. like I feel like mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. on Earth, we're pretty against. I think this is one thing. If you want to describe the entirety of Earth and humans by this characteristic, being generally anti-interspecies dating, that's pretty solid rule of thumb here on Earth. One that I certainly am a fan of. But not so in the Star Trek universe. I love it. Like, she's not worried about, like, okay, how does sex work with your people or anything. She's just all about it right away.
I mean, when you got a hunk of man meat like Ogden Steers right in front of you.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. When your alien race is human but with some crap on your face, as is also often the case, she just somehow knows it's all going to work out. But anyway, she falls madly in love with this guy. And that's the conflict, because she is coming from the position of, no, this is insane that you're going to go back to your planet and just kill yourself. You got so much life to live. 60 years old is not that old. You got so much more to do. You got your work. You got your da-da-da. And meanwhile, Jean-Luc, of course, following Star Trek protocol here, is not going to interfere. You know, he's not going to interfere with this process. So that's, I think, sets up the conflict. And I don't know if you want to go spoilers or no spoilers on this thing from 1991, but it's a good episode. I like it. And it really, really a little tear jerking, I think. A little tear jerking.
Oh, this episode made me cry for sure. I'm not even going to pretend that I didn't cry at the end of this episode.
Nice.
For sure. And like, so, you know, they go back and forth really beautifully in the second half of the episode. There's a wonderful debate between Loaxana and Stiers. And it's like, it's a great long scene with a lot of really just well-developed dialogue that feels very honest and like really weighs the issues. And like, his character considers breaking the law for a while. And then, you know, you're right. Let's not give away how it works out at the end. But I think it's a really beautiful piece about how to try to balance sort of caring about other people and respecting their wishes, essentially.
Yeah. And I also think we can start getting into the philosophy discussion, but, I think it's also interesting. It is a good episode. I don't know if we can non-spoilers it. Why don't you go ahead and start with our philosophy here, and we'll see. We'll avoid spoilers, I guess.
So I wanted to bring this episode in because it's a better version of Logan's Run, and it raises an important topic within ethics that I often see people, I think, misunderstanding. And so I wanted to use this as an opportunity to clarify, first of all, a sort of distinction between important concepts. Which is the difference between what's called cultural relativism and what's often usually called ethical pluralism. So this gets into like differences between realist and anti-realist views on ethics, basically whether, you know, your view believes that there are certain moral claims, like you ought not to murder people at the age of 60 just because they are 60 years old, right? And that those claims are true independent of what any particular culture believes about them, right? So that's a kind of basic moral realist kind of view. And then on the flip side, you have a lot of folks, especially coming out of anthropologist traditions, who sort of follow a version of the prime directive and really think that... So there are people who come out of the anthropological tradition who adopt a kind of prime directive sort of view, where they think that, whatever any culture adopts for themselves that they agree upon is good for that culture, in the sense that we shouldn't sort of come in and intercede and judge other cultures. And so it's a debate between them and what but folks like myself tend to adopt, which is the ethical pluralist view, that there may be different acceptable kinds of cultures out there in the world. There could be a bunch of different cultures that are within a morally acceptable framework of balancing important moral concerns. But outside of that framework, there are certain cultures like space Nazis who are bad no matter what they think about what they're doing. There's no way for them to justify that behavior. And so
would we be allowed to space punch those space Nazis? No, let's not get into it.
Right, but that is the question, right? That is really the fundamental question, is you know, the difference between the cultural relativist and the ethical pluralist is there is a point at which the ethical pluralist says this is wrong and we're intervening. And like,
yeah, and for my part, and feel free to poke holes in this, mm-hmm. I would say forcing a healthy person who's living a good life, or really anyone. I mean, I could see an argument for if someone's really unhealthy, draining all kinds of resources and going to die anyway, then, you know, a pull the plug situation where it might be ethical to have a rule in your society is like, we're not going to devote this many resources to someone who's you know, has a fatal disease or whatever it is that's not going to work out anyway. But if the rule is at 60, no matter what, no matter how well you're doing, you got to kill yourself. I feel like that's a pretty safely not acceptable idea in any culture for me personally. What do you think?
I mean, I intuitively lean the same way you do. And the question then becomes, is that personal or cultural bias on our parts? Is that, because that's what I really love about the debate back and forth with the main characters in this episode, is that, like, you know, he really does honestly raise some interesting questions about death with dignity and what it means to have a good death. And like,
yeah, I guess I could have set that up a little bit more. I mean, the reason they have this rule is it's now, help me out. Something like they're in the history. They weren't able to care for.
Yeah, they essentially went through a period like what we're going through, where the elderly are shoved off into homes and die lonely. And, you know, medicine allows them to live longer than anyone wants to, you know, them to be around, is the way he describes it. It's like, so it creates this kind of dystopian image, and then argues that this is a solution to that problem. And I think it is interesting to note that our culture hasn't come up with a good solution to that problem. So it's interesting that we are reflexive in thinking, well, that's not the right solution, even though we don't really have a perfect alternative at the moment.
No, it's pretty reasonable to say that's not the right solution, even without a...
I do still tend to agree with you that it is the wrong solution.
How can you judge our solution of pushing the elderly into an incinerator if you don't have a better solution, Aaron? No, that's not how things work.
So you lean towards the ethical pluralism, is that what
I'm
you're
going
saying?
To have to disagree with you on this one, Aaron. I feel like we can very safely say this is not the solution while we don't have a better solution currently.
I agree with you. I was just laying out the potential responses that you are likely to receive, right, as an ethical pluralist trying to foist your you know, blah, blah, blah style, blah, blah, blahs onto other people. So, but I think... it's fascinating in the episode because, I mean, I do think we should maybe talk the ending, right? Like, I think it's fascinating that they come down in a very mixed kind of way, because he ends up deciding to go through with the ritual, and the last scene is her coming to go down and observe the ritual with him. And so I'm curious what your feelings are personally about, you know, if you knew someone who believed in something like this, would you support them in that? Would you sort of try to change their behavior? Would you refuse to be a part of it? How do you feel? What do you feel about her decisions in this?
Well, I think that there's a difference. I think it's interesting here to talk about perspective, because I think it's easy for me and Loaxana and anybody else to be like, well, that's a stupid thing. This shouldn't be the rule. But I do think it's different. I think what this episode does a really good job of doing it, and it sounds like we're just doing spoilers, so sorry, everybody. Hopefully you paused and watched it. But what it does a good job of illustrating is what the reality would be for David Ogden Stiers, or Stiers, however you pronounce it, which is his whole culture and family and everybody has been raised under these cultural assumptions. And I think it's a Star Trek 1.0 thing where it's too easy to make the alien characters take the human perspective because it's our perspective, you know. But I like that in this episode, he does. The main reason he, I think, considers not going through with this ritual is because he thinks he's on the verge of saving the planet, you know, and he. So that's the main reason. There's also, he does also buy into some of Loxana's arguments of, you know, he still has life to live, and he would like to spend it with her. But I think what pushes him the most is this idea that he might be the only one who can finish this work. And then what happens in what I love about this episode is, you know, it's kind of dark, you know, because the what happens is when he requests asylum, because he's like, okay, I'm on the verge of this discovery. I can't go back and commit suicide like was planned. Mm-hmm. And so when he does that, though, his whole planet shuns him, and the science, you know, foundation over there, whatever it is, they cut off communication.
Mm-hmm.
So like they're so dedicated, which I think is also, you know, it's not unrealistic. I think they're so dedicated to this practice and it's so ingrained in their culture. They don't even care if he comes up with an idea to save the world. They're like, nah, sorry, not even this is them's the rules,
mm-hmm.
which like I could almost see, you know, like there's certainly not. Doesn't seem impossible to me, you know. It seems like, and so what I started off to say was, it's one thing to say, well, this rule is stupid and it shouldn't exist, and it's you know, it's horrifying. Making if there's one thing that I would think even Aaron Rabbi would be able to embrace as a culture, as a non-cultural relativistic, like an absolute rule, it would be not making a person kill themselves when they don't want to, like that. If you can't embrace that, then I, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I'm an ethical embrace. Pluralist, right?
Yeah. Well, okay.
You're right.
I don't know.
I
there's got to be some line, otherwise, there's what is ethics?
Right. I do think that there is a line. I totally agree that there is a line.
And making an otherwise healthy person who could have good quality of life just kill themselves, to me, to my mind, pretty. If that's not over the line, I don't know what is. But anyway, the point is, let me just finish this part. From his perspective, though, given that your entire planet and family and society and everybody you know is 100% bought into this, he actually, his daughter comes and visits him and is like, well, I'm ashamed of you now. And it's a good scene between them. And his whole, like, reputation is ruined. His everything is ruined. And to the point where he's like, well, never mind. That was a bad idea. I'm going to go kill myself at the end. And it's not that casual. It's very well done. And you get it. Like the decision makes sense. You're like, well, do you want to live as an exile from your entire planet and society and culture and family? And basically your reputation ruined, your legacy ruined, or do you want to go kill yourself? And it's like, okay, I could see that being a wise decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's an important note, and like some folks suggested when I was discussing that we were going to be doing this episode that we should get somebody on from a culture that we ourselves might view as traditional, you know, like regressive in some kind of way, since both of us come from a, you know, fairly affluent first world country. But I do think that there, you know, I think I can at least tiptoe towards the conversation about how there's a lot of complexities when you discuss harmful cultural behaviors like female genital circumcision, or however you the term. There are debates even over the terminology that you should use there, but there's, you know, there's a lot of sympathy I think that we have to have for individuals put in the situation of having to choose between their culture and doing this thing that is problematic, right? Is harmful, and I think you're right that's something that I think sometimes gets lost in our discussion of, well, this is clearly wrong, but how should we deal with the individuals who are forced to make these hard choices? And so that's why I love so much at the ending that she chooses to stand with him, even though she's still morally against it, I think.
Yeah, that part seemed like,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, to me that wouldn't have been a difficult ethical thing, I don't think. For me, it would have been like, you know, if it's somebody that I'm fond of, I mean, they've known each other for precisely 45 minutes here, but if it's somebody I'm fond of and they do choose to go through with it, I might be angry with them for not going through with it. But like, I don't think there's any reason to not take part in the ritual that they do and the celebration of life thing. Like, to me, that particular question I don't know. I didn't spend much time on that thinking about it, but that's interesting. Is that, was it your intuition? Like maybe a lot of people would like, you know, I'm not going to participate in this at all. I'm just going to, let me say that again. I'm not going to participate in this at all and just kind of protest and not get those last moments with somebody they are fond of.
Exactly. Right. Some people would feel like they would be condoning it in a way that they weren't comfortable with, or they didn't want to deal with the emotional trauma of having to see someone who they have cared about deeply die. Or, I mean, I guess one way to read that to me is she does better for him than anyone in his own culture could do. His own culture was willing to, you know, mistreat him essentially to achieve their desired ends, but she's not willing to use that same kind of manipulation of him to try to get him to do what she wants. She's willing to respect him as an autonomous individual in a way that I feel like even his daughter isn't.
I guess that's true.
There's a bit of deontology versus utilitarianism here too, obviously, right? Like, one thing I want to point out when you were back when you're talking about the rule and stuff is that you can also read this episode as a contrast between two kinds of utilitarianism: act utilitarianism and rule utilitarianism, the two most common kinds. This is a great example of a culture that's living according to a kind of rule utilitarianism, where they have settled on a line and it is universal for everyone. And there may be some situations where someone dies a little early or someone dies a little late, but at least on average, they're producing the best amount of happiness. And the idea there is, if you left it up to act utilitarianism, where everyone decides when they think is the best time for them to die or not, you'd fall back into the old kind of system.
Yeah, I guess this would be like a bad side of rule utilitarianism, because usually rule utilitarianism comes to the rescue when it's like, well, what if you're in a hospital and, you know, that whole situation, like, should you just murder this guy to get... transport all his organs to other people and save six lives? And it's like, well, okay, if that's the rule, like if you're saying that that's the society we live in where you could just go into the doctor and get hacked up while you're under general anesthesia, then that's a bad rule and that's how you should evaluate it. But it's interesting, I guess you're saying this is like the other side of it where you're setting, does that distinction make sense, though? I feel like this rule could exist in either. Or you're saying, yeah, I don't, let's see.
Are you asking if this is a utilitarian culture, really?
Yeah, I'm not sure that it is. Like, I'm taking this from
the part where he sort of gives that monologue about why they did this. And I like the monologue he gives, it seems to me, is to say, you know, we had massive amounts of suffering under the old method. So under this new method, we are maximizing utility via the application of this rule.
But I still don't, I wouldn't think anyone in the earth would think they're maximizing utility by doing this. I could see the argument that, like, this rule is better than the previous system of nobody taking care of the elderly, but certainly maximizing the utility would be, okay, well, we'll do our best to take, let's devote resources or something, come up with some system. And by the way, let's have an exception when someone is totally healthy. I think you're just an anti-utilitarian activist.
I am not.
Trying to come up with horrific examples that wouldn't even make sense under a utilitarian system.
No, what I'm pointing out is that within every subset of any theory, ethical theory, but it's, you know, utilitarianism too, each sub theory has its own strengths and weaknesses, as you're pointing out, right? There are strengths to rural utilitarianism. It prevents murder hospital, but there's the weaknesses, which is a rigid rule is always going to have bad outcomes in some situations. You're never going to write a rule that's perfect enough to avoid all of these problems. This is an extreme version,
but that's
certainly
not a problem of, like, that's more of a problem with other kinds of ethical systems, I think.
No, that's a, like, big problem with rule utilitarianism. And
it's a big problem with, you know, the whole thing of, like, you can't tell a lie. Who is that?
Yeah, that's deontology. And so what happens is, right, so as you shift from act utilitarianism towards rule utilitarianism, some will argue you basically slide towards deontology, that like as you try to put in general rules, you end up creating a system
they have a basis in reality and in what we think the consequences would be versus this idea, some ideal you have of like, well, a good person is honest, so therefore never lie, even if you have,
sure,
you know, Anne Frank in your home, you can't lie to the Nazis. Like
the justifications are different, but the problems are the same. The theories face similar problems in up-rigidity.
I get that they could be similar, but I don't think they're the same in that a lot of the problems of deontology would be that your sourcing is bad. Like
I'm not saying they face all additional problems. The same. I just mean on the front of rigidity with regard to harmful outcomes in scenarios where the rule doesn't optimize well-being is what you get, right? And so what happens is, right, then they try to make the rule more and more nuanced, the way you were describing, right? Maybe it's not exactly 60, maybe it's, you know, be more open towards people, you know, choosing to end their own lives at the right time or something like that. And so you try to find a more functional balance, but at any point where you sort of try to draw the line, there you'll always have trade-offs. Right. So if it's just like a society that allows for euthanasia, you're still going to have some situations where individuals feel coerced, for example. So some will argue that you shouldn't even allow euthanasia. So again, like I agree with you that in this case, this particular society falls outside the bounds of acceptable. But I think it's a good case study in how it can be very difficult not just to know how to interact with individuals living in that culture, but how to draw that line between cultures that are beyond unacceptable and cultures that are just weighing things out differently and coming to a different evaluative conclusion.
I mean, the main thing I was rejecting was this idea that this rule is maximizing utility. I think that's absurd. Like, there's no way.
Well, sorry.
This rule is maximized. It might be
what I was saying. Again, is there an example?
It might be
of
better than like how their previous system was or something. But it's not. There's no way this is the maximum. Like, utilitarians have to agree with this.
No. There's no way. I was saying they were a model of a version of rural utilitarianism. I didn't mean a successful version. Right. They are an example of people adopting a not very utility principle for actually trying to maximize utility and then following that rule even though it causes harm, right? So you can say that they're bad rural utilitarians. that's what I'm getting at here.
It's just the bureaucracy, you know, right. It's just trying to legislate for the masses.
I do tend to lean towards the ethical pluralist view, but there are more difficulties that we can sort of continue to unpack in future episodes about how to draw those lines in maybe more difficult cases than murdering people at 60. I'm curious to hear what people's thoughts are on these sorts of things, because I do think, especially within the liberal world, there is a little anxiety towards any view that is willing to at some point say your culture is just wrong and we're going to intercede.
Yeah, that's the thing. And there's different lines too. Like, is it, you know, your culture is just wrong, but it might cause more harm for us to try to intervene, you know, like that's kind of a medium level take there versus no, everybody's equal. You know, effectively it's the same. I guess if you don't intervene effectively, there's not really a difference between saying, yeah, that's fine. And we hate it, but we're not going to do anything about it. You know, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's really tricky. And like, you know, we make a lot of jokes about the Prime Directive being terrible, but like, I do think it is an attempt to try to address these very hard problems. And like, if you look at global politics right now,
would you say it's a rule that has trade-offs?
Good. You're learning. I'm so proud. So I guess that's about all of that.
Yeah, this is, you know, the philosophy is a lot of stuff we've touched on before, but this is one of those episodes where it's like, hey, everybody watch the episode. I think it's well done. And again, especially if you get past the first like 10, 15 minutes. After that, it's really good. I like that it's, as we were talking about, you know, it doesn't give you a happy, you know, bow on top kind of ending. It presents a problem, doesn't give you a perfect solution. The things people do kind of make a lot of sense, you know, like the choices mm-hmm. everybody makes make sense, which is something that I am sensitive to. Like that's what bugs me when I'm breaking down fiction, is like when people's choices make no sense, like they wouldn't do the thing, you know. That's very much not that. This is mm-hmm. I think it's well written, and one you should definitely go hop on Netflix and watch if you have Netflix. It's up there.
Yeah, and it's just peak design work. A lot, there's like I went back and rewatched it, and like honestly, once you know what you're getting into, if you rewatch the first half, it really is an impressively brave setup. You don't find out what the episode is about until 30 yeah. minutes into the movie, or into the episode, excuse me. But you get like such great setups.
It's so true. I was watching, I was like, what are we talking about with this? Yeah. Besides, again, the ethics of just shooting someone on the bridge to make sure they don't cause an intergalactic war by messing around with buttons on the, it's really infuriating. But it does definitely delay.
Yeah, I love the opening. It has Diana Troy doing the captain's log, and the entire captain's log is "my mother is on board," and then it cuts to a shot of Picard like nervously trying to exit his quarters.
Yeah, that's the ongoing comedy of it. Is like she's funny. Always obsessed with Picard. Yeah. Oh, good times. All right, we're going to hop on over to After Dark. Thanks so much for listening. This is a great Star Trek episode. I do recommend it. Let us know how wrong Aaron is when he says that this might not be beyond that line, because I think this is easily beyond
that. This is how philosophers get in trouble with the media, right? Philosopher says maybe it's okay to murder old people shows up in the news the next day.
Oh, I was going to say that. If the rule were nobody can be in politics beyond the age of, say, 60 might be a tiny bit too, maybe 65. That would solve a lot of our current problems, just saying.
There you go.
Hashtag just saying. We get a whole bunch of out-of-touch people who are in their mid to late 70s are in charge of everything. My parents are in their mid 70. They don't know how anything works.
So in After Dark, we're going to discuss at what age Thomas believes that we should murder old people.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. If this episode were, no, I'll save it. I'll save it for the After Dark. All right. Thanks everybody. And we've got to do our end of episode rituals, of course, because it is a rule that we follow and it has no downsides. And we got to thank our patrons at Patreon. Our top patrons at patreon.com/0G. What are they making you say this week?
Yeah, special thanks to our three top patrons.
Three? Oh, you guys are the best.
If I'm not a clone, what's this three on my forehead? Amazing.
Nice. Oh, that's a good one.
Aaron's inability to read names is influencing Thomas. Are you having some trouble with names, Thomas?
I think that might be a crossover comment, because I do from time to time. I did have a total brain fart and pronounce a name inexplicably terribly.
I'm so glad that I'm infecting you. That's,
I know. Yeah. Like it was the kind of thing I would have made fun of you for forever. So
how much infecting you does it take before you become another version of me? Like what, 51%? Right. All right. So our last thank you, right? Philosopher, I hardly know her. The classic.
It's a great one.
Someone did that with Bandersnatch, and I was very impressed.
Oh, good stuff. And of course, you've got to give us a little preview of next week's episode.
Yeah, I can give you a preview on the content, though we got a surprise guest potentially for this next one. So I don't want to spoil it or ruin it or anything, but we're going to do the movie Annihilation. And hopefully our guests can fill us in a little bit on the book, because neither of us is going to be reading it between now and then. But the movie is great. It's on Amazon Prime right now. So check it out.
Nice. Looking forward to that.
You're going to hate this movie.
Oh, really?
I mean, you're going to like maybe parts of it and then hate me for the last 20 minutes or
don't
so.
Don't you tell me what to do. I'll like or hate it. Tell me what to hate. I find it good. That's the thing. You can't influence me on this, you know? You can't.
No, you're I thought earnest. I would hate, I'll give you that.
I thought I would hate Good Place, and then I didn't. I zigged when you thought I was going to zag. You never know. You never know. I'm true to my beliefs. All right. Thanks so much for listening. And definitely hop on over to the After Dark right now.
That's all for the main show. But if you'd like to go to patreon.com/zeroG, you can enjoy Philosophers in Space After Dark. Here's a little sneak peek for you.
I think it's pretty common for people to think, okay, I would, if I can't do this, then never, you know, like, just kill me. If I can't, you know, do such and such anymore, I'll just end my life. And then they get to that point and they're like, well, you know, I could still watch Netflix. So, okay, well, if I ever can't watch Netflix, just I'll end my life.
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/zeroG. You can find us on Twitter at zeroG Philosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.